Halleluja. Halleluja. We thank you for your love, Father. It's higher than the heavens and deeper than the sea and goes wider and deeper than all the things within human hearts that we can't even see, Lord. We thank you that it's big enough to fill the void and the chasm inside of a human being. We ask you to touch us today. Bless everyone here, Lord. Grant that we could walk in your freedom, the freedom that your Son bought for us. And I just ask you, Father, for your grace and provision now, and that you would bring blessing, health and strength to us all in Yeshua's name. So I'm just going to mention a few words that I want you to have in your head. One of them is infant. Infant, what is the definition of an infant? How old can you be? What? Well, the question you can answer. I think of an infant as a pretty young. I don't think of a human being as being an infant for terribly long. Anyway, infant, milk, weaned, solid food, mature, and digest. Those are the words I'm just going to throw out there. And then there's some phrases. Great things, beloved son, beloved child, and like a weaned child. So, I'm going to read you Psalm 131. My heart is not proud, O Lord. My eyes are not haughty. I do not aspire to great things or matters too lofty for me. Surely I have stilled and quieted my soul like a weaned child with his mother. Like a weaned child is my soul within me. O Israel, put your hope in the Lord, both now and forevermore. That's the Berean Study Bible, and this is it in the New American Standard. O Lord, my heart is not proud, nor my eyes haughty, nor do I involve myself in great matters, or in things too difficult for me. Surely I have composed and quieted my soul like a weaned child rests against his mother. My soul is like a weaned child within me. Israel, hope in the Lord from this time forth and forever. So from there, I'm going to kind of sort of go into the story of Esther and read you this out of the Heritage Desk Diary. If you send them a donation of any kind, they'll send you this once a year for the rest of your life. Well, they'll probably keep sending it after that too. At any rate, this is a little box here on the bottom of the entry for this Shabbat. which, by the way, is our wedding anniversary. I guess you all know that. So we were so young back then. I was 22, which, of course, is pretty old. My wife was 19, which, you know, by the standards of certain times, was getting up there in years to still be a spinster. So, you know, we got married and we started this long, long journey. And boy, I got to tell you, a lot of stuff has happened. That's the short version. In order to prove that I can be brief, I will leave it at that. So this is what it says. Just says, from Purim, its observance and significance. Parsha Zakor sets forth the commandment to exterminate Amalek. Since Haman was descended from Amalek, reading this portion on the Shabbat immediately preceding Purim juxtaposes the commandment to eradicate Amalek with its fulfillment, namely the wiping out of Haman. The name, unfortunately I can't read the Hebrew and it doesn't give the English right there. Anyway, the name literally, remember, is taken from what? The name Zakor, literally, remember, is taken from the first word of the portion. The Haftarah is from 1 Samuel 15, which describes King Saul's battle against Amalek and his misjudgment in allowing Agag, king of Amalek, to remain alive for one night. Now, what do you think happened on that one night? I don't know if that's a happening or not. Now, this is from tradition, of course. So, that night, Agag cohabited, and the child resulting from that union became the forebearer of Haman. What do you think of that? I suppose it's possible. At any rate, there's a principle in it. And by the way, I'm no expert on Talmud, and most people aren't. But a lot of people read a little bit of Talmud, and then they think that they can make broad condemnations of the way that the rabbis thought. But in probably most, if not all cases, somebody that knows nothing, even if they have a positive sense, will not actually understand what it is the rabbis are up to, why they're discussing that particular thing, or why they end up coming to the conclusions they come to. It's just not that easy. And that became more and more apparent to me as I got to know Jacob Neusner and also talked with people who did understand the Talmud. And I like Mike Brown's exhortation to believers who just make judgments about the Talmud. He says, if you want to understand something about the Talmud, ask a rabbi. It's actually pretty good advice coming from a messianic Pentecostal Jewish scholar. The guy knows an awful lot. Better place to go to a rabbi than to most other sources if you really don't get it. At any rate, the principle is sometimes what we hesitate on produces things that continue on for a long, long, long time. So, if we just assume that what's said here is actually the case, then if Saul would have just done what God told him to, there never would have been Haman. And then there would not have been this peril for the Jewish people. course, then there would also not be the story of Esther. Or I don't know, maybe there would still be the story of Esther, but it just wouldn't have been Haman. I don't know. At any rate, Saul is he's taken by the really nice spoil and some of the stuff, and so he keeps it, and then he claims that, well, he did this because he wanted to offer it to God, and really I did do what I was supposed to. But what this thing out of tradition actually ends up teaching is that what you hesitate on, dwell on, and sort of decide to keep in your pocket instead of just throwing it away can really, really come back to bite you. And in Saul's case, it bit him long before Haman came on the scene. So anyway, from there, it's like, I don't know why I said it's like. From there, we'll go in toward the story of Esther. So depending on your point of view, God is hard to find in the book of Esther. If you're trying to find the word God or the name of God, you won't find it at all. So it's not just hard to find, it's just not there. But then depending on your point of view, God can be hard to find in everyday life, or seems harder to find when there's trouble. Anybody ever experienced something like that? At least somebody. I've heard more people say that, you know, it's like, where's God? I don't see God. God's not doing anything. God's not here. What's going on? You know, because of trouble, right? I mean, it's kind of a natural response. When I think about that, I think, okay, well, wait a minute. Maybe God's actually harder to find when everything's good. And we just, since we're not, maybe, possibly, we're not looking for him so much then. I'm speaking very generally. We can be looking for God every day, even if things are going well. And it just depends on the condition of our heart, right? But if things are going really, really well, we don't have this intense sense of total need for God to intervene because we're kind of happy with things, right? And if we don't need intervention, it's easy to get a little just taken up with, you know, baking those cookies and building that shed and going on vacation and, you know, I mean, whatever. Just whatever daily life is made of. And so I don't know. I mean, it may actually be harder to find God when everything's fine. And that's when I think about believers in China and their view of believers in the West, apparently those believers in China think that a lot of believers in the West aren't really finding God very much because they aren't in dire need. I'm not expressing, I know that, I'm not expressing an opinion, but, you know, I know that John Wesley saw all of England transformed under his ministry, his brother's ministry, John Whitfield's ministry, and then there were other people involved. It was a massive, dramatic transformation, and he lived long enough to bemoan what he observed, which was it seemed that the preaching of the gospel brought redemption and salvation, and that then that resulted in prosperity, and that prosperity resulted in falling away. And that is what happened. England began to just return to its former state. And I don't think its state right now is all that great. So anyway, what we let remain may really become a problem. And, you know, if only the things that are supposed to go were things that we found stinky and unattractive. You know, I don't, like when I find a dead mouse in my house or in some place that I'm inside of, I have no difficulty taking that thing and like throwing it out in the woods or you know, burying it or something. I don't feel, to be completely honest, I mean, sometimes when I find a dead mouse, I don't just get rid of it. I might want the skull, or I might want to, you know. And then if it's been dried in an attic where it's warm and it just dehydrated so fast, like it's freeze-dried, I might actually want to keep it, but that's just me. And I'm getting a signal from the ground crew that I've gone on to 209 and I should have stayed on 32. And I've noticed, too, that there are things that stink to one person but don't stink to another. We probably all have some things that are attractive to us that stink to somebody who's really thinking right. But there's something attractive about it to us. We all have our pretty ones, our precious ones that we kind of want to keep, even if we have some knowledge that maybe the Lord wants it to go. And then there's this phrase I always remember, others can, you cannot. And does that sound familiar to anyone? Well, what that's really about is that sometimes the Lord has a particular thing that he says is not for us as an individual. It reminds me of Peter turning and looking at John after Yeshua has said something about how he's going to die. And he says, well, what about him? And Yeshua says, well, what's that to you? What's that to you if I want him to just live on? He didn't say that he wasn't going to be murdered or that everything was going to be fine. He's just saying, look, it's not, why are you bringing that up? What's the point? I'm talking to you. This is what's going to happen in your life. Does it need to happen to everyone else just so that you can feel good? Or if, you know, I mean, really, would it have made him feel better if Yeshua said, well, you're going to end up crucified, and so is he. So, you know, it won't hurt so much because it's going to happen to both of you. I mean, I could imagine the thought of being crucified and hoping it didn't happen to my friends. At any rate, others may, you cannot. It means that the Lord may want something removed from our life, and it might be something he seems to let everybody else keep. And he doesn't really care about everybody else if he has this thing, this particular thing for us. And so it's not really about proving that the thing is a good thing or that it's an acceptable thing, because that may already be proven. It may just be we're not meant to have it. And if that's the case, it has to go. So moving along here, we get into the story of Esther, and I'll read this from the fourth chapter. I'm not going to cover the whole story. We all know it. The Jews are in exile, and Esther ends up taken into the king's harem, and then things progress. So this guy Haman has come into the picture, and Mordecai won't bow. So then it says this in Esther 4:1, when Mordecai learned all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the midst of the city and wailed loudly and bitterly. He went as far as the king's gate, for no one was to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. In each and every province where the command and decree of the king came, there was a great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes. Then Esther's maidens and her eunuchs came and told her, and the queen writhed in great anguish, and she sent... Now, this is the part I want you to pay attention to, is Esther's response. First of all, she writhed in great anguish. That sounds pretty intense. And she sent garments to clothe Mordecai that he might remove his sackcloth from him. Now, why would she do that? I mean, can you imagine someone's, so that what? Well, he wasn't the only one doing this. So she sent garments to clothe Mordecai that he might remove his sackcloth from him, but he did not accept them. So Esther wanted to remove the ashes and sackcloth. It seems that she wanted the fasting and the intercession to stop. So then Mordecai responds a bit later. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not imagine that you, in the king's palace, can escape any more than all the Jews." So, was she afraid maybe that since Mordecai was her uncle, it would be discovered that she was Jewish? Was she afraid for her own life? Was it the right thing to do to try to get him to take off the sackcloth and ashes and put on, you know, acceptable clothes? Was that the right thing? "Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place." And you and your father's house will perish. So he's saying, the Jews are going to be delivered, Esther. But if you think you can escape, if you remain silent and you don't do anything, your family is going to be left out of it. I can just see God being clearly intoned here, even though he's still not mentioned outright. God's going to deliver his people, Esther, and you can play your part, and that could be really great. But if you don't, you're going to just be out of the picture along with your family. And who knows whether you have attained royalty for such a time as this. So, heading back in the direction of Psalm 131. There's a sense in which we need to learn to stop fighting in order to start fighting. Does that make any sense to you? The battle is truly one of the mind. That's where the battle of faith is won or lost. As one thinks, so is he. It says, ask a couple of questions here. Was Esther a weak girl who hid her identity, or a strong woman through whom God brought the victory? What? You abstain? At one point, she scratched for milk and safety, according to her own thinking. Then she became weaned and was able to chew, swallow, and digest solid food. So it says in 1 Corinthians 3, "And I, brethren," this is Paul speaking to the Corinthians, they were, by the way, a perfect congregation, exemplary in every way. They knew the scriptures well, practiced them, and they really, really desired spiritual gifts. They had everything needed to have just a fabulous congregation. Well, actually, I think that last comment is true. I think they did have everything needed. "And I, brethren, could not speak to you as to spiritual, but as to infants in Messiah. I gave you milk to drink, not solid food, for you were not yet able to receive it. Indeed, even now you are not yet able, for you are still fleshly, for since there is jealousy and strife among you, are you not fleshly? And are you not walking like mere people? For one says, I am of Paul, and another, I am of Apollos. You're acting according to man." When Paul's talking about that, what do you think the difference between an infant and a mature person is? I've never really thought about it before the way I've thought about it this week. When a baby's born, it nurses, right? All of its sustenance comes from its mother's milk. It's just, that's all of it, right? And there's a point comes when the baby doesn't drink milk anymore. And what do you call that point when the baby doesn't drink milk anymore? Weaning. The baby is weaned when it does not any longer drink milk. It's hardly an adult or grown up. I mean, it's not what we would call mature, right? But I have this sense, now you can be very, very mature and maybe less mature, but at one point can people be spoken to as spiritual people? Do they have to be like, what are the words that people would use? Highly advanced. Very, very learned. What do you think? It seems that there's a point where you don't have to have just milk, and you can chew, and then you can swallow, and what you swallow gets digested. Before, you just sucked and swallowed, and the milk got digested, but it's not the same as solid food. I don't know. How would it go if we tried to live on mother's milk our entire life? I haven't studied the nutritional, I'm not sure. It seems that it was kind of meant that other things would get eaten at some point, right? So no matter what point a person is at, you get to a point where you've been drinking milk and digesting milk, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with having needed milk or drinking the milk. There's no criticism implied that at one point a person needs milk and that's really the stage they're at. There is an implied criticism here, of course. Well, it's more than implied, that they still just need milk, but they ought to be able to handle something else. So all of a sudden I envision this point in time where somebody, they're going to eat solid food. They're not going to drink milk anymore. It's like, oh, they're weaned. And what is weaned? What does a weaned child look like? David compares himself to a child that's finally weaned. Before the child is weaned, some of you may have seen kids. I mean, I've talked about this before, but not for quite the same reason. That are on their way to being weaned, but they're not happy about it. I mean, they'll tear at their mother's clothes. They'll fuss and cry. In some cases, they're able to talk, and they'll express exactly what they want and their complaint about not getting it. I've seen that happen. So David realizes that a grown man or a grown woman can act like an unweaned child. And he's talking about the point here where he has quieted himself and he's gone to God with it. And so now he's able to be like a weaned child, just leaning on the mother, or I think leaning on the Lord, right? So before that, he says, my heart is not proud, my eyes are not haughty, I do not aspire to great things or matters too lofty for me. So if you look at a number of biblical stories, but we're looking at Esther right now, I think Esther didn't aspire to great things, right? I don't see any evidence that she aspired to great things. She didn't involve herself in great matters or things too lofty for her. She actually seemed to want to just sort of keep a low profile. She wasn't thinking about it. The point of the psalm isn't that great things won't come or that you won't end up involved in matters too lofty for you. It's that they don't come about by being proud and haughty and trying to exalt yourself or get the things that you think you want. You following me? Haman wanted greatness, didn't he? He wanted to be bowed down to. He was proud. He wanted to be great. He wanted to lord things over other people. It didn't turn out so well for him. Mordecai doesn't seem to have wanted a great position. He just wanted the Jews to be saved. Esther was just a girl who wasn't looking to become a queen or a deliverer or the means of God's redemption for people under the threat of annihilation. She wasn't looking for it. In fact, she didn't want it. She tried to run from it. You know, we have no idea what the Lord might want to involve us in. He might want to take any one of us and use us in great matters, things that are way beyond us. And he can choose to do that. There's two ends. There's running from what the Lord wants to do with us. And then there's running and straining toward the things that we want God to do with us. Anybody ever struggled with either of those? Esther just, from her own point of view, seems like she just ended up in this situation because she was a member of a people in exile and she happened to get taken by the king when he was looking for a replacement. And she's afraid. And her uncle seems to, I'm not going to say that I don't think he had any fear, but the fear that he had didn't stop him from acting. It didn't make him try to be pretend not to be Jewish, and it didn't keep him from putting on sackcloth and ashes. So anyway, he lays it out for her. You may have attained this position for this purpose. This may in fact be why you're here now in that place, so that you can be used for God's deliverance. But hey, it'll come from someplace else if you try to protect yourself now. So then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maidens also will fast in the same way." All of a sudden, she's just like, she's really decisive all of a sudden. "I and my maidens also will fast in the same way, and thus I will go into the king, which is not according to the law. If I perish, I perish." So Mordecai went away and did just as Esther had commanded him. In terms of solid food and weaning and maturity, it seems that all of a sudden Esther, who I'm going to say, was just wanting to sip on milk, all of a sudden just got weaned and started chewing on solid food. She's not straining. She's not trying to protect herself. She took the exhortation and she realized what she must do. And all of a sudden, this girl is taken up in, I think, matters far too lofty for her. Greater than she ever even thought about, not by her choosing, but by God's sovereignty, which until then, at least, I don't know that she could see at all. Up until then, perhaps just nothing but circumstances. And she tried to control the circumstances by getting her uncle to chill, take off the sackcloth and the ashes, don't make a scene, let's just keep a low profile, Unc. But he's willing to risk it all, and she finally becomes that, and she's willing to lose her life in the service of her people, and I'm going to include in the service of God who delivers. She didn't involve herself in the great stuff or aspire to be a bold heroine. But that is what she became. It seems that you can go from fear and shrinking away and perhaps a very low estimation of yourself to bold acts of faith and being used by God to deliver many in a matter of a few minutes by a choice of one's will, when the truth is just laid out for you. That is what it looks like she did. So, we're all in a battle all the time. Sometimes we know it, sometimes we don't. The battle's never lost in the external physical world, and not determined by the circumstances around us or the limitations that we see and reason about. We may want our wise uncle to play it safe. I had a wise uncle, by the way, that didn't play it safe. He spent over 20 years in Pakistan, and he told me, when I asked about some stories I'd heard about him, he said, well, I am kind of a fool's Russian type. I think he was being humble. Fact is he risked his life to preach the gospel to people who could have killed him at any moment, and in one or two cases, I think we're about to, but God just sent a rescue from what would have seemed like nowhere, like total coincidence. I always admired that about him. So, David talked about being like a weaned child. He says he doesn't aspire to great things nor involve himself in things too high for him. It's a state of mind he's talking about. It's a condition of the heart, way of thinking. And he's in this peaceful place like a weaned child, not straining for some big new thing, and in that moment, anyway, content with where he's at. He knows his position and is standing with God, and that's enough. There's a difference between what we have wanted to involve ourselves in and what we aspire to, all of our ambitions, as you know, that we sing that song, All My Hopes and Plans. Surrendering them all. The difference between all that and what God chooses to involve us in. And the Lord does ask us to move on into the higher calling that we have in Messiah. In the book of Hebrews, it says, solid food is for the mature who, because of practice, have their senses trained to discern good and evil. There's a single thing that I think, if we really looked at it, which would make a huge difference all the time. Well, it's not a thing, it's Yeshua. He came here as a man. He went from infancy to adulthood. And the one thing I think that we could say he always did, which is key, is that he walked as his Father's beloved Son. And because of what he came and did, we were made to be God's children. And the scriptures say that as he is, so are we in this world, which is a pretty mind-blowing passage to read. Really, as he is, so am I in this world? But that's what it says. It's not saying we are Messiah, but we have become what he is, and we can walk in what he walked in, which is the knowledge of whose child we are. And if we're always walking in the knowledge of being a child of God, then the straining towards big ambitions and all of that stuff fade away. And the fear of what will happen in terms of earthly circumstances and rejection and whatever else we might experience also fades away, because we're walking as God's beloved child. And that just changes everything. So I don't know what all of you think of yourselves, but from what I understand, there's enough energy in a raisin, if we're all released at once the right way, to blow up the entire earth. I'm telling you, there's something way more than the potential of a raisin and its energy that's in you. And that is the Spirit of God because of the work of the Son. And we don't have any reason to be afraid. Well, we may have reason to be afraid, but if we look at our Father and remember whose child we are, then the fear just becomes irrelevant. What? There you go. And you shouldn't leave it overnight to cohabitate with another fear and produce a bunch of Hamans. So, Father, I just ask you to show us Yeshua. Pour your love on us all. Pour your love and your encouragement on everyone here. Bless the fellowship that we have, Lord, and I pray that more and more would grow out of the love you've placed in us, an extension of it, and a harvest among people that yet need to be adopted and brought into your family, into your kingdom. Just pour out your blessing, Father, in Yeshua's name. Amen.